All right, and welcome to episode number 36 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Rebecca McKendry.
What is up, Rob?
Hey,
I like
there.
You over on the side of the
hey,
table.
Oh, yeah. We're positioned differently.
Oh, this is weird.
We rearranged.
Oh, my God. Elric is like to my right now.
Like
Elric
a Kane. Kinky sex trio that's just, you move slightly after a couple years and that just feels better. it's more fluid. I'm feeling it.
You feeling this?
Interesting. Becca's in the middle.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Becca sandwich going on.
You guys
on
got
here.
Weird.
I don't want to sound sexist, but
don't
it is
get
hot.
Weird.
And Ryan Turek is still at Sundance, but I believe he's on en route back
Slacker.
Yeah,
to the offices.
He apparently has been seeing some really good stuff.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty excited to hear his full report next week on the show from Sundance.
I have been enjoying his tweets on what he is seeing and what's good.
He's been pretty active on the group, letting people know some of the recommendations of what to look forward to. So that's
did Blumhouse make any official pickups there? Or like actually publicized pickups?
Not
that we can
that are publicized.
Okay.
We did do the private screening, or not private, but the
premiere.
It was the quiet, secret screening of Get Out.
Which is awesome. And I read some reviews about it saying that it was just a great movie. Forget just a horror film. It was just this great film, which I'm really excited for.
I was like, because I could talk about it now. The soundtrack was like my favorite part. I cannot wait to talk to you guys about that.
I'm excited.
Cool. Y'all
haven't
seen the trailer. I don't want to see any more until the movie actually comes
out. Neither do I, And I want to see that with an audience. Because I have a feeling just if he's pushing buttons, I want to see how people react to it. You know, which is cool.
It's going to push buttons.
Cool.
So we've seen some stuff this week, right? But am I the only one that saw Split?
Who goes to Blumhouse movies?
I think so, because I had trivia on the night that it opened, and then I didn't get to see it this weekend. Because
that's unbelievable.
I want to see it.
Okay. Yeah, me too.
So it wasn't avoiding, because I liked The Last M Night. I enjoyed The Visit a lot.
Yeah, all right. Well, then I will talk about it minimally, but I did see it. I saw it last night. I wanted really badly to see it before this episode, and I loved it.
The Blumhouse screening of Split, because usually if Blumhouse is opening a movie, they'll do like a company-wide screening.
It was
while we were interviewing Jackie Kong last week.
Yeah. So. We actually sent her daughter into the...
Did we get her review? Did you hear what she thought?
No, I didn't.
That's interesting.
But I personally, and I'm obviously not going to do spoilers or any of that stuff, although somebody really did ruin it for me right before I went to see it.
And
I don't want to say ruin. That's not the appropriate term, but gave me a certain sense of context that I wish I had not known going into the movie.
Right.
That said, as a horror thriller... It's really, really solid. And I mean, I'm somebody that loves his first three. I love everything up to about The Village. You know, I like the first four movies. Everything in between has been whatever. The Visit to me is really silly, but fun.
It's so fun.
Really fun.
Yeah.
I don't take it seriously at all.
No.
That's the thing. It's like, well, this is okay, but it's not like traditional M. Night. The Split is old school M. Night. And what I mean by that is it definitely tonally feels like one of his first two movies. And part of it is when he gets the right actors and he can direct them the way that he did with, like, say, Bruce Willis in the first two movies, it is spot on. And James McAvoy, he can do anything.
He's a great actor.
He absolutely pulls off all these multiple personalities. They all have different accents and different, like, body language and all that kind of stuff. So for something that I walked into thinking, honestly, was going to be a silly premise, I was actually kind of taken back by how seriously he took it and how good McAvoy was. Plus, the girl from
The
Witch.
Right?
Yeah.
She's amazing.
I didn't even recognize her in the trailer.
I didn't either. I didn't know until after I saw the movie that was the girl from The Witch.
Uh-huh.
So acting across the board was great. And it's a cool, fun, tense little movie. And once it was over... And I processed it, and it's more of a post-credit thing rather than a quote-unquote twist. I can't even call it a twist. It just kind of is a little bonus, like, hey, maybe we could change the context of what you just saw this way.
And you're after the credits?
Yeah.
No, not like after. It's like, well, the title comes up,
okay,
and then you get a scene, and then the credits.
Okay, got it.
So I really loved it. I thought it was great. And again, the less you know, the better. as usual. But it's definitely a return to form for him, and I hope he stays that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because
I think he would be one of the best possible guests we could get in here. Like in terms of storytelling and career at this point, especially someone who has had real peaks when you start mm-hmm. with such a big hit in your first film. Well, it's very hard to.
You know what's fascinating is before I went to see the movie. I own all the stuff on Blu-ray. I revisited Unbreakable, which I don't think I've seen probably in at least 10 years. Mm. And it's my favorite of his films by far. And the bonus features, I was like, oh, let me watch the bonus features again. Seeing an interview with him back then when he had just finished Sixth Sense, and he's like, look, man, if I could, I just want to keep making movies that are feature-length Twilight Zone movies, you know, like episodes. Yeah. And I'm like, that's totally exactly his niche. Mm-hmm. And maybe it kind of fell a little off because, you know, for the most part, there aren't any bad Twilight Zones. There's always something about all of them.
Right.
But when you do X amount of them, you're going to kind of have a story that's a little too
flimsy. Except the 90s reboots.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are pretty
bad. I liked the
okay. The Forest Whitaker hosted ones are a little.
Yes.
There are
clunky.
Some in there that are a little not so good. But
what is the status with his Tales from the Crypt then? Because that seems like a good match.
Yeah, I don't know.
Sound like it was happening.
I thought I heard that something. I'm speaking totally from a fan perspective.
Yeah. I'm going to Google this while you guys.
Well, I heard. You know,
TNT, right?
They're working on it for TNT. I heard through the grapevine that there are suddenly unexpected rights issues.
Oh.
I don't know what that is. It could be that HBO still owns the title Tales from the Crypt.
I'd much rather be on
or
HBO.
Or maybe the Crypt Keeper, the character. Yeah. I don't know. There's some complication.
It would be able to push it a little bit further.
TNT is going to kind of have to soften it.
Yeah, like make it for teens.
Yeah.
But I always loved M. Night, how every single one of his movies was really high concept.
Oh, yeah.
And they had simple execution, but it was never like, when you look at his overview, it's not like this is his haunted house film and this is his zombie film. Like none of his films look like anything else.
Yeah, his alien film. I mean, I think The Village is actually pretty good. I know that one polarized big time.
Yeah.
There's something about it I quite liked, and I quite liked Signs at the time.
I like Signs a lot.
But man, I did not like Lady in the Water, and I never saw The Happening.
And you were correct, Rob. The last updates I'm seeing came from right before Christmas saying that the TNT series Tales from the Crypt, M. Night Shyamalan, had been paused because of budgetary issues and potential rights issues.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah,
hope
so
they can figure it out.
I'm seeing a couple of different reasons listed here, but yeah, it was supposed to be a 10 episode order.
Turek should get in touch with him and do Blumhouse's own version of a Twilight Zone-esque show, rights free.
There you go.
I want to do a quick thank you to one of our listeners. Sometimes you guys send us stuff, which is always incredibly kind. And I got this a little while ago. Josh Pasnak, I've said a lot of terrible things about Canadians in the past. The most important I usually say is that they're perverts with great wallpaper based on Connexploitation films. That's all I know. But I will say you're a good man for sending me. He sent me one of my first films, The Reflecting Skin, which is only available on Blu-ray there in European Blu-ray. It's not an American Blu-ray.
I bet that looks gorgeous.
Yeah,
I mean,
I'm looking forward to checking
that
out.
That movie, I can never watch it again. That was one of, like, it messed me up.
It's a pretty fucked up movie.
Nothing really happens in it.
Well, things happen, but it's one of those really dark adolescent stories, and I started getting on 35 last year and loved seeing it like that. So that's super kind of you, and I hope to repay you one day by giving you 160 free episodes of a podcast. Thanks, Josh. Okay, so one fun one I got to watch, which I'd never seen. This year I feel like it's the year of seeing slashers from the 80s I hadn't seen, which I just love that feeling because even the ones that aren't great are fantastic. I saw Sweet 16, 1983.
Whoa.
Jim Satos.
Does this have a cool box cover I should
be
remembering?
It's got literally maybe the best of all of them. It's a girl. You've probably seen it. It's a girl in a lake and her body, lower body forms a knife.
I know.
Oh, now I know the one you're talking about.
Never seen it. So.
I think my new favorite subgenre of the slasher film is Texan slashers. Hmm. None of them are great. Like, none of them work. Like, all the ones I've been seeing, like, what was the last one we saw was the
Slaughterhouse?
The Invitation.
Oh, The Invitation.
The Initiation, sorry. The Initiation was a Texas one, and there's like a couple other Texan ones I've seen lately. But the cool thing is, my favorite Friday 13th lady, Dana Kimmel's in there as a young girl. It's one of those really cool concepts, which is a hot girl from the city moves to a small Texas town, and every time she takes a guy out, something comes and murders the guy. And so she becomes the suspect. Everyone thinks she's lusting and killing these men. Mm. And she's about to turn 16. So you start reading into it all these cool adolescent problems. And then it does what all these films that don't work, including the one Edge of the X, which we were talking about, is it'll have this subplot that somehow becomes the A plot and takes away from the story you're interested in. And suddenly there's cops like following Indian guys and trying to frame Native Americans for the crimes. And you're just like, what are you doing? Come back to the hot girl seducing guys. Like, so it's kind of frustrating. I think it would actually make a great remake movie where you just take that kernel, you take the poster art, and you are away. But I did like it, and I think that it's kind of fun. It's a Code Red title on a Blu-ray. I didn't see the Blu-ray assort streaming. It might have been on Shudder. I do it through Amazon, so I can't remember if it's because Amazon has Shudder. Really cool movie. I'll do two while I'm here before we move on. Just this one's short because Rob talked about it maybe back in Killer PV. A film I've always loved, The Hidden.
Oh, yeah.
Jack Shalter. Yeah. It played on TCM Underground.
Because I'd watched it.
That's been my, since the, like, I first started as a kid, I've always thought that's like a masterpiece. But I hadn't seen it, in like 10 years.
Yeah.
As far as action horror goes, it's probably my favorite action horror film.
It's great.
But there's an actor in the middle, if you have seen it, who plays the creature. And it's one of my favorite horror performances now, the old guy. Mm. He's in there for about 20 minutes, like probably the longest sequence. And he's like eating and farting at a restaurant. He's like, the way he physically plays it, it is like on par with, I mean, he just looks like this really boring actor when he gets possessed by the thing gets inside him, this alien centipede type creature. You'll certainly see the creature a couple times in the whole movie, and yet somehow you're totally by what it is. Like, it's, I mean, you're like, why is this like creepy slug like acting on impulses, human drives, you know, lusting after things? If you haven't seen it, do whatever you can. The biggest bump, it's one of those films that just absolutely should be on Blu-ray.
Have you seen the sequel?
Yeah, it's not a good movie.
Okay.
I haven't seen it in a long time, though, but no one was in it from the first one.
Okay.
So, which is a real shame. And this is like, you know, perfect Kyle MacLachlan, you know, where he, as Dick Gruner said, perfect hair in the movie.
Oh, yeah. He does have perfect
him
hair.
Him at his peak.
At his peak, super young and very alien. You know, he feels like there's just something. But also the chemistry. And I was thinking about a double feature, and there's a lot of obvious double features, but I think actually the perfect one with that is Night of the Comet, because it's the inverse. It's two girls versus the two guys. Because this is like a two-guy buddy cop, and it's a little more serious. But I feel like Night of the Comet would be like a really nice pairing with that film. But man, if you there's a good DVD out there. It's pretty nice.
Yeah.
I would see it. If you haven't seen this one, I think you're definitely a party, you know?
Yeah, it's terrific. Excellent action, too.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Jack Shalter, somebody I met at Texas Frightmare, and I said to him, you know, if he doesn't live out here, I said, definitely come on the show, because Alone in the Dark, that, and his Nightmare 2,
right? Yeah.
They're all so freaking well made. He's a really good director. He knows how to put a film together. I'm very curious to know how his career worked, when he didn't work and why, and, you know, all the politics behind it.
Yeah.
Very curious. So hopefully that will happen eventually.
Yeah, I'd love to get him on.
That'd be cool.
Sure. Nice. Becca, what have you seen?
I watched Clinical on Netflix. Mm-hmm. This is the direct to Netflix one.
Yeah, I was curious about that.
Yeah, it was kind of a miss for me.
Okay.
Like, it just, it.
What kind of genre is it, subgenre is it?
It's kind of Sixth Sense-y meets Primal Fear, I guess. It's about a psychologist who, long ago, she sees one of her patients kill herself in front of her, or attempt to. The patient's still alive. And so she goes through this kind of post-traumatic stress of what it's like seeing a patient try to kill herself. And after a while, she decides to take on another trauma patient again. And so while she's taking on this new patient, she's also starting to have visions of the patient who killed herself or tried to kill herself, which you established from the beginning that she survived the whole
That's
thing.
That's a pretty common story arc. I feel like there's like the ward and things like, you know, I feel like that's been done in many. Is there a twist on it?
No, not really. I mean, like, there are small twists throughout, but I was really expecting more. And I was really amped up about this one because Netflix had been so good with Spectral and Hush and I Am the Pretty Thing That Lived in the House, like all of the direct.
But was this a pickup or was it actually, you'd be worth looking, because if they funded it, that's different than if they picked it up.
I'd be interested to know.
Okay.
Because this one, it didn't feel as tight as the others. It honestly, it felt like you could feel production problems in it. But I mean, I loved the setup. I was really hoping it would be better. The guy who directed it had done a former film called Diabolical that I didn't see, but
last year.
Yeah, I saw good reviews for it online.
He's friends with a lot of people we know. I know Jackson and people like that. They all told me that film was coming out. But you know, what are you going to do? You can't win them all.
Yeah. and I would love for some people to check it out because I'd love to have some people to discuss it. See if I missed something. And then the other thing that I saw, I was talking with Elric about this before the show. So a few years back when I was still working at Fangoria, and Fangoria did its 300th issue of the magazine, It was me, Chris Alexander, Mike Gingold, and Sam Zimmerman were the main people there at the time. And we were trying to figure out what to do with it. So we decided to go and pick the 300 best horror films ever made, like the 300 must-see horror films throughout all of history. And we put them all in the 300th issue. And I've been kind of going back through the 300 and trying to see which ones I need to rewatch or which ones I didn't see to begin with, because there were a couple on the list that I'd never even seen before at the time. So I decided to go back and watch Bloody Pit of Horror from 1965. Have you guys seen this one?
Never heard of it.
You need to. It is Italian. It is some campy, fun Italian horror from 1965, directed by a guy named Massimo Pipillo, which I'm probably saying wrong. It is definitely got kind of that Italian fashion vein that we see really kind of surge in giallo films. But it is about a group of models and a photographer that decide to go into this old 17th century castle to do a photo shoot. And then, whoops, there's this like crazy madman executioner there who starts torturing them all. And he's like, dressed like a Spanish wrestler, which is even more fun.
I think they went the right direction once they hit giallo with a masked, subtle killer, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely got like Marquis de Sade overtones. It's got really fun costumes. It's campy. It's definitely trying to be a little bit more erotic than it actually comes off. But yeah, it's fun. It's got some good horror moments too, but it's basically fun.
It's always hard for me to like want to go see a campy, like when that's one of the words, it's hard for me to, I like if I'm watching it, I can get into the, but like when somebody says that, I'm always like, oh, I don't know if I want to watch campy. You know?
Yeah, I know. That's, you never know what that means.
Yeah, exactly.
I will
if
say,
it means self-aware.
This
or
means not self-aware. Cheesy. Like, yeah. I don't think it was
Herschel
made
Gordon
to
Lewis,
be like
because I, you know, that I can get into, but it's
better than Herschel Gordon Lewis. Like Herschel Gordon Lewis, I would call campy because it was kind of like, he didn't
amateur
always put forth
yeah.
the greatest effort to make the greatest film ever. Right. Yeah, it's got like amateur actors and he would kind of phone it in on some things. This, like the filmmaker really freaking tried.
Okay.
It doesn't come together as cohesively as a lot of other horror at the time, which is why I call it campy, because like the eroticism isn't really that effective. And there are okay, Elric's really into like
wrestling.
The erotics. It's a really fun horror film, and it's
Bloody
kind of a classic, so you got to check it out. Bloody Pit of Horror.
Alrighty, I pulled up some Netflix information since you were talking about Clinical before, and did you know that Macon Blair's directorial debut, I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore,
which just played at Sundance,
is premiering on Netflix February 24th.
Nice!
God, that's so quick.
Yeah.
It just played
on
Sundance.
Netflix.
And it is not a horror film. Ryan went to the rafters on that one. He called out Bloody Disgusting.
Okay, yeah, because the horror sites are running it, I think, because of the Macon Blair connection.
Yeah.
And Jane Levy's in it.
It sounds to me like horror, like Blue Ruin's horror.
And Elijah Wood and all that. And speaking of Blue Ruin, the director, what's his name? Jeremy
Saulnier is doing that Wolf movie, right?
He got a Netflix original movie.
But
he's
a big,
doing
big book. Like, it's a bestseller, and it's awesome that he's going to take a big step. Like,
yeah, it's cool that they're getting those opportunities for Netflix.
They totally deserve it. That's the cool thing.
I have heard complaints about Netflix. I think that one of our friends on Facebook actually referred to it as a media graveyard because the stuff that goes on to Netflix, it's not like you're ever going to own it in your collection. But then again, would you? Because it's probably always going to be on Netflix.
Well, they say that, but you never know. Like, it could end up being, like right now, that makes sense because they want to keep the original content. But at some point, they might end up being like a library that says, I'll let
license
Twilight Time do 1,000 copies.
It could.
I think if people like Flanagan talk to them and say, hey, it would be really cool if we did a sub-license so people could collect us, maybe a year or two later, when they've kind of gotten the bulk of their plays.
Well, I think they waited a year and a half to do, there's a physical version of Daredevil now, for example, the show.
So they are doing some media.
That's the only example I could think of. And the thing that's a bummer, I would pick it up because I'm a big comic book fan, but it's featureless. So it's like, what's the point?
Yeah.
Right.
The whole point of buying it, that is you'd want the bells and whistles and maybe the making of and commentaries and things like that. So it's interesting. I think it's a little too early to say.
Yeah, as big as Stranger Things was and kind of the geek and fan market that surrounded it, that's the one that I think that they would probably benefit from.
Oh, yeah.
I'd buy that
if I had a lot.
Right, that's a good one to keep.
Yeah, I think in the long run, it would be interesting to see. I think Filmstruck is one of the sites that seems to be uploading extras and stuff.
Yeah.
Because I think that will be when streaming really changes. Like, when if you have Netflix and then they have a button you can push that says extras for all those same titles and you can watch everything that would normally be on a Blu-ray and they start producing that content.
Sure, sure.
I think that would be a real interesting move.
Have you gotten Filmstruck yet?
Yeah, I did.
I'm
Filmstruck
seriously
for,
considering it.
I don't know if I'll keep it yet or not. It depends how much I use it, but I got it to watch this film, a Russian film called Stalker. And
well, they have the Criterion
library.
I've
seen the Russian film Stalker.
Criterion and Turner Classics. Yeah.
But can you watch it on your TV?
Yes.
Yes. So
depending on your
what?
TV.
You just need something called a Fire Stick. You just plug it in the back and it works.
Yeah, or okay. Like we have a Roku. It doesn't work. I have a Samsung TV, which it does not work on, but I also have a Roku, and you can push it through the Roku.
It's still fairly beta, so it will change once it's like Amazon or something will start carrying it.
Yeah, that's what
it's new.
That's what happened with Shudder. Once it was on Amazon and I could stream to my TV, then I got it. Mm-hmm.
It's like with the show, I tend to watch so much horror that it's almost not worth having something like that.
It
with
did seem to
Criterion,
have a lot of horror on it.
No, they have the Criterion horror and they have some of the other, but there, I go through waves, so you know if I swing into all that stuff, it looks great. The films look brilliant quality. Mm-hmm. There's cool essays. They're treating it like a great site, kind of like what Shudder is doing.
Yeah,
for horror.
They kept saying it's like the Netflix for total film nerds.
Oh, yeah, I mean,
and I keep seeing the ads for it, and then I'm like, maybe I'll sign up for the trial. It looks cool.
You can do free like 15 days.
Yeah, I mean, access to all the Criterion stuff is a winner for
me. Yeah, and it took off from Hulu.
That's what I loved about Hulu,
yeah. And they took it. So, and they're smart to do that. They gotta pay the money so they can keep putting out great stuff.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because every one of these streaming services is going, it's people are acting surprised and as if the whole streaming thing is unpredictable. When I was trying to make a point with a friend online the other day, I was like, no, they're literally repeating the model of cable television. Mm-hmm. They're replacing cable. You had HBO, Showtime, you know, whatever thing you wanted. Now it's you have Netflix, Amazon, whatever. You're just paying for your specific channels that you can now get on your TV.
Yeah.
So it's like the same thing when you were saying, like, all right, but if they're creating original material, that's kind of like how HBO used to do the HBO First Look.
Yeah.
They do their little 15, 20
they were cool.
thing to kind of fill in the gap between 2-hour arcs.
I think this is the watershed year for all of this partially because of the Oscars. Like, we have films that very well could win Oscars that were made by Amazon and made by companies that you just don't like. Even seeing Jeff Bezos, the head of it or whatever, I think it's Jeff Bezos or whoever the guy is. You're going, oh, weird. He's in this room of all these Hollywood celebrities, and now he's suddenly one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And just like that, just because he has money, and you're just suddenly it's a whole new landmark. So it'll be interesting to see where that all goes. But none of this compares to Friday the 13th Part 2.
That's the truth.
I decided to. I'm gonna cherry pick through the whole series, go one by one again. I've seen them all, you know, within the last few years, but some less than others recently. And what's interesting about two, and it's the only one really, I mean, one a little bit, but it's so freaking grounded compared to the others. It's so much more like realistic. It feels like the thing I always liked about two is the opening feels more like a Halloween movie because it opens in suburbia for a few shots and you're like, what? That always threw me when I was young. But watching it this time, I really enjoyed watching it. I even enjoyed the fights with Jason stuff. It feels definitely pre-supernatural. It feels like, oh, this is a real stalk and slash, and all the teenagers felt completely real, because three is when it really gets, you know, over the top with the kind of caricatures. But I really enjoyed seeing it again. But the couple of things that really left me thinking was just how much of an impact Steve Miner had on what those films are, because by doing two and three, you've literally just dictated what Friday the 13th is forever, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he really, I mean, there's no one, I can honestly say there's probably no one I'd rather us get in this room. And I know it's probably impossible because he didn't even do the Crystal Lake memories.
Yeah, that's true. But
is he still in L.A.?
I don't know.
No, he started doing conventions and stuff. I have a connection that can go directly to him. I'm just curious if he doesn't care about those, because I like his other films.
Yeah.
I
mean,
you know, he's done a lot of interesting stuff, Lake Placid.
Oh, no, he's done
Soul
lots
Man.
Of stuff. And the H2O, Halloween H2O.
Lake
Halloween
Placid.
H2O exactly. Is like a fun return. So, I mean, he's always, but it's just, he's had a huge impact, but there's a cut in it. I mean, Ginny's great. I've always, you know, Ginny's one of the best final girls.
Yeah.
But there's a cut in that where the little dog walks up to Jason's feet, and then the next shot is hot dogs on a barbecue, and you're like, that's why you watch these movies.
Right, for that little
It's that kind of fun. So, yeah, next week I'll watch 3 and 4. Probably and just work my way through again just for fun. And just a couple real short ones. I want to remind people about how fucking good the score is to There Will Be Blood, because that is a fucking horror
That's
score.
That's not a horror movie, Alric.
It's a horror score. No one would argue.
Oh, no. I'm just mocking that you guys say that whenever I mention something
For one, I would actually argue that to the rafters, that that is a horror film. It's one of the most horrifying ever.
Like he calls it a
yeah,
horror film.
I think it is a horror film just dictated by the fact of how the music impacts the movie. But that music on any movie would be fucking scary. I mean, it's just the strings. Everyone, that's Johnny Greenwood, right?
From Radiohead,
it's so fucking good. I showed it to a class yesterday, talking through the lens of like Trump stuff, and I just couldn't even believe how good it was for that. It was like, oh my God, how great is it that a movie set 100 years ago tells us everything we need to know about today, which is so depressing. But just the score, I did want to mention, because I know people are always in the hunt for scores, and I was thinking, I'd love to listen to that on a vinyl now, because it's fucking great. And last night I watched Beware the Slender Man.
The HBO doc. Uh-huh, yeah. So
it's heavy. I watched that one as well.
Yeah, Ryan was a big fan. He had mentioned a while ago, I was hoping he'd be back to discuss it. You know, my big takeaway was just, it's very sad.
Yeah, that's how I felt.
It's not scary or
any
of those
things. It's not horror.
Things.
It's like a Forensics Files episode that goes horribly bad and depressing.
Yeah, I think I like it. I think it's a really good doc. I think it's especially good at thinking about what the rabbit hole of the internet can hold for young minds and screen time and the way kids, you know, we just don't think about what they're doing because, hey, we don't look at that stuff. So why would a 12-year-old? But 12-year-olds are highly impressionable, and watching these girls, and I won't spoil it, but it's not that kind of story really. But hey, the good thing is that girl who was stabbed lived and is totally fine now, and besides major psychic scarring, I'm sure. So that's a nice part of the story. But the actual crime side of the story is fucked up. The Slender Man stuff is fascinating, and there's a lot of creepypasta. It's you know, a lot of it is about that side of the web. Mm-hmm. I kind of wanted more of that to kind of know what see other points of view of how people can really buy into that fantasy.
Yeah, felt very much like a focus on the psychology of why these girls kind of believed in it wholeheartedly and not so much of an exploration of the creepypasta.
Right.
And I think that a lot of people probably did want an exploration of the creepypasta, but it really did become kind of a character study instead.
Yeah, it's a tad long. It's two full hours, and I feel it's the kind of thing that's probably more of a 90-minute thing. But, I think everyone who listens to this show should at least watch it.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting.
And, don't be expecting a light and happy thing. It's heavy.
And urban mythology, I mean, it's amazing that one really caught on. You know, it's a faceless boogeyman who's not really the bad guy in the lore. He's kind of the one these troubled kids want to go to him. They're doing it to be one with him, not to hide from him. That's the kind of scary part.
Yeah, it looks like, I mean, Screen Gems is finally making a movie of it.
Okay.
So, interesting.
Who do you know who?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't remember. But
I'll look it up. They did announce the director.
Yeah, I posted about it. Somebody was asking me about it today, and I keep forgetting. But so it'll be interesting to see how a narrative version of that plays out.
I wonder if it'd be based on the other creepypasta.
Yeah, and if they can kind of, how do you skate the line between the, like, things like that true crime and the
real
actual
people.
Mythology and stuff like that?
Well, there's also one of the biggest problems, and I have an article about this on the site as well, that you don't see a lot more creepypastas getting turned into movies, is that there's always rights issues. Because the whole
point.
Who owns
it? Who came up with it?
Yeah, who added to it? Because the whole point of like Slender Man is supposedly one guy created Slender Man, but then if you look at the chain on Reddit, like, 50 people added to it.
Right.
So then, you know, let's say that you, in your movie, there's the Slender Man and you make the girl that he's talking to named Karen. If that's in one of the threads, then somebody could come back and be like, I came up with that and you now owe me money. So there's like huge rights issues.
Just have a better lawyer.
Because
it is a gray area.
It gets into a real gray area. Just
our Channel Zero
so
friend must know all that.
Yeah, they talked about it on the show.
Yeah.
They're, you know, they've so far they've only tackled ones that they've been able to find
the
chain
rights.
Back to who created it.
I'm still trying to figure out who's doing the Screen Gems one. I know it was announced.
I literally somebody asked
Sylvan White.
Yeah, that's it.
We should do a whole side episode of just us on our phones looking things up.
I know. Hold on, guys. We're all on our phones here looking up this.
Regarding other stuff I've seen, I checked out Scream Factory put out Dreamscape.
Oh, yeah.
Which
Dennis Quaid.
Yeah. You know, I've never seen this movie, but I always thought, judging from kind of like the artwork, I always thought it was like an Indiana Jones style thing.
Yeah,
I don't know why. I guess
there was a sequence like that. But
Yeah. But it's actually, it does, and it's not really horror, but it definitely delves.
Well, it's fantasy.
There's fantasy, and then there's elements that could, I know if I was saw it at 12, I would
be scared.
As a
kid, seeing that snake thing scared
the snake
fuck
creature,
out of me.
Sure. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, that's basically it. Dennis Quaid is kind of this, he's got psychic abilities, and he gets pulled into this facility run by Max Van Sydow.
Isn't Christopher Plummer bad guy in it, too?
I think so. I don't remember.
Christopher Plummer, I think, is one of the main bad guys, and he never blinks, and he's in a telephone booth at one point and gets run down.
Yeah. So that and Kate Capshaw is in it.
Oh, yeah.
And all that. But yeah, so it deals a lot with dreams because they take Dennis Quaid, who's kind of like a psychic, and they bring him to this facility to try to, you know, it's kind of Inception, like infiltrate people's dreams and stuff like that. Yeah. So there's a kid, for example, that constantly has nightmares that this snake man is trying to get her. Him. And so basically, you know, in one sequence, Quaid goes in there to help him conquer this demon. So it's got a little Dream Warriors style in it and all that. It's a fun.
What year was that compared to Dream Warriors?
It
must be right around the same time, right?
The one thing I didn't write, it had to be mid-80s, maybe 85 or so.
Yeah.
But it was directed,
look it up. But it was directed by Joe Rubin, who did, you know, I mean, quite a career, Stepfather, and then things like Sleeping with the Enemy.
Just
like
Canadian.
Such an interesting director. Yeah. But yeah,
1984.
Cool. There you go.
And it was like so Dream Warriors would be 86, 87.
Yeah, I think Dream Warriors was after.
So it was a little before that. So maybe Dream Warriors saw that. I was like, let's do the really fucked up version.
As a kid, I'd say like it's great. And when I rewatched it a couple years ago, it was on TV. I was like, oh, that's really clunky.
Yeah,
the
optical effects don't really work. Yeah. Is what's, you know, but it's, you know, it's kind of, its heart is in the right place. And I could see it being a nostalgic piece for people.
It's a nostalgic piece for Dave because he made me rewatch that a couple of years ago. And he was like, oh, this is this great film from my childhood. I love it. And I spent the whole time going, really? This is like, this is like your Indiana Jones. And but he remembers it as being this amazing film that he watched in repetition when he was a kid. But
that's a fun thing at 12, like some of the effects and stuff, that's, you can overlook all that if there's a fun thing,
concept. Totally.
Especially in the 80s where the movies were all fun like that, you know.
And the other, I saw one other thing that I've been wanting to see this film for a long time. I thought it was a made for TV movie, but I looked it up and it was actually made, it's rumored to be the first HBO original movie from 1985 that Kino Lorber put out, and is called The Park Is Mine. It's not really a horror movie, but it stars Tommy Lee Jones. And here's the thing. Tommy Lee Jones already did my favorite vet movie, which is Rolling Thunder.
Baby. Rolling Thunder,
so good in that movie.
Let me just get my gear.
William Devane. Oh, God. One of the best, most kick-ass lines
of
anything.
Best movies
ever. This is almost like a spiritual sister to that.
Oh.
And basically, Tommy Lee Jones is a Vietnam vet that is living in New York City, can't hold down a job. His wife and him split, doesn't want to see his kid, etc. And at the very opening of the film, one of the guys that he served with has cancer and can't hack it anymore, kills himself. But he leaves him a note and maps and all this stuff. And he's like, look, you know, it's a social commentary because it's like they forgot about us. We went and fought this war. They forgot about us. Nobody listens. Nobody cares about each other anymore. He's like, but I have set and booby trapped Central Park. So Tommy Lee Jones puts on the gear and he takes Central Park.
Oh, cool.
Wow.
For 72 hours. The park is mine. Huh. And nobody's allowed in there unless basically he wants to be heard that, you know, about people, how they've been treated, how vets have been treated and stuff like that. So it's super cool. It's definitely kind of in that Rambo vein.
Yeah.
It's not nearly as violent or anything like that. It's not like he, you know, kicks all this sort of ass stuff. But there is some good stuff in it, and I just thought it was a cool little
Where'd
gem of a movie. I bought the Blu-ray of it. For a long time, I had it on my – I was going to rent it off Amazon Video, and I don't know the quality of the version that they have. But then Kino Lorber, that's been putting out a lot of these interesting kind of lost action movies and horror movies, they put out a Blu-ray of it. I bought it for like $15.
The soundtrack is Tangerine Dream.
Oh, well, God, I didn't know
which
that.
Which I totally want to hear over top of like this war aesthetic that you're describing. Like, it sounds like Falling Down.
No, it's very Falling Down. It's very Rambo. Oh. It, you know, it's just that sort of thing. But, you know, Tommy Lee Jones in that period, you know, kind of at the height.
Badass.
He's so damn good in it. So I really like that. I wanted to mention two other quick things that are somewhat unrelated. I listen to Mark Maron's podcast quite a bit.
Yeah.
I really want to recommend, he did an episode with Roger Corman. It's episode number 776 of Marin or WTF. And the reason I like it is it's, you know, here's the thing. We've heard a lot. If you're even remotely a Roger Corman fan, you've probably heard all the stories. You've watched all the movies. He's got it down to a science, like his responses and all that. This is a really fun episode in that, you know, usually Mark does his little intro and then he brings the guest on, but he does his intro. And then there's snippets of Ron Howard, Joe Dante, that have been on his show when they talked about Ron. He cut those out of his old episodes.
Wow.
He's like, before we have Roger on, let's give context. These are a few of the people talking about him. And then he brought on the director. His name is G.J. Ektern Kemp, who wrote and directed, no, didn't write, directed Death Race 2050, which is the new...
Which is now on Netflix, right? Or it's coming to Netflix?
No, it's on Netflix now, and they put out a Blu-ray of it, and that's pretty much what Roger's promoting now, because... And he explains it all in the actual interview, but basically, he made Death Race 2000, and then he kind of licensed the name out for the Jason Statham movies, and they've now since made three of those. And apparently that franchise is, there's a fourth one of those coming. So this one is Roger Corman's Death Race 2050, which is a direct sequel, sort of, to his original.
Paul Bartel.
So now we have the two concurrent Death Race franchises or whatever. I hate to say it, but it's unwatchable.
I mean, I already figured.
Yeah, I put on the first like 5-10 minutes and I'm like, I just can't do this. But it's weird. So Maren talk, you know, he plays snippets and then he talks to the director of it. And I think it could be one of the most depressing interviews I've ever heard.
Oh no.
Yeah, I mean, the guy had directed some little film that Marc Maron starred in. So they have a little bit of history as a young guy. But what's depressing about it is it's, you know the difference when somebody talks about vintage working for Corman back in the early days, he didn't have any money, blah, 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 this and that, but we figured it out, da, 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 da. For some reason, that happening now is just sad. We pretty much dressed up the cars in styrofoam. Look, it's a crap movie, direct to video, and da, 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 da.
Yeah.
Then the director's just like, yeah, I don't know. I got offered another car movie like this, but I don't know if I want to be like stuck doing that. And I was just like, man, this is the most honest, like depressing direct to video. And then it cuts to Roger Corman. Yeah. Who, even though I've heard a lot of stories, he's 90 years old, still super sharp, and there's some really great stuff that Mark got out of him. It's a great interview.
Cool.
So it's definitely worth a listen.
I skipped to, I actually listened to today the latest one, which is Martin Landau.
Oh, wow.
And it's one of the best Marins I had heard, but this more specific if you're somebody out there who's interested in acting at all, because saying people didn't know much about Landau is that he is the, he's kind of the main acting teacher of LA for the last like 50 years. And he taught Jack Nicholson and all those guys.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people have always said he's a better actor than he is, a better teacher than he ever was an actor.
He was in something I watched this week.
Well, I mean, yeah, Ed Wood and everything, The Being, Jackie Kong's The Being.
And I feel bad we didn't get to, before we went on last week, she didn't tell it on air. But she was saying she got Orlando to be in The Being by taking his class.
Yes.
It was like the sole reason she took his class just so she'd be like, hey, look, I'm making a movie and I want you to be in it.
Yeah, and she was like, I'm not even an actress. I'm making a movie and I wanted to be near
and
you.
And he was so flattered to get the hustle. Asked that he did it. So.
He just comes, look, he's 88. And when he's talking, he has a memory so sharp. Maren even says, you remember things better than I do. And he's hilarious and he's very Jewish. He's just got that great voice and he's having a good time. He's still acting, but it's just like a treasure trove of a career in acting and teaching people. So if that stuff interests you, that one, I haven't heard the Corman one yet, but I thought that was a great one.
Yeah, no, I'm gonna check that one out too. And the only other thing I wanted to mention, which is horror related, but kind of, I was telling Beck about this before we started. So good friend of mine, friend of the show, Dave Parker, he has invested now in the PlayStation VR. Now I don't know much about VR stuff, and I like being passive when it comes to movies. Like, I don't want things coming at me physically. So I've seen little bits of it. We've tested stuff here in the office where it's kind of like you put the phone into
the Google Cardboard.
Yeah. That's what you showed me. But this thing is all encompassing. It's like a giant thing that goes around your face and your eyes, right? And then you put in headphones. So it's like it plugs in all your senses.
You know, when they have sex in Demolition Man, that's what it looks like. Holy like where it's like right, this
the three
thing.
Three seashells?
No, that's when you use the bathroom.
No, it but says you. Like, you can use it for either.
So I stopped by Dave's place and he has been playing around with some of it's like some of it are games, but some of it are actually
experiences.
Yeah. And he's like, "Here, let me show you one." And I was sitting, in the middle of the room, put this thing on, he didn't tell me what it was, but it was a virtual world shark encounter.
So
it's gorgeous. You are in a tank, and they're lowering me in. And I guess I'm exploring like a sunken ship or whatever. And you get and you have a little flashlight on your forehead. So as you turn your head, you could look up, you can look around, and everywhere you look, you see jellyfish around you and all these like beautiful like sea life. And I was telling her, like, you look down and all you see is darkness except for what your flashlight's like, because keep lowering you, slowing down. And, you know, it looks pretty good. Obviously, it's kind of got a CG element. But the thing is, when you have headphones on and you're fully immersed in this, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And again, he didn't tell me what it was. So I'm in it and I start, and he wouldn't respond to me either. So I'm screaming out. I was like, wait a minute, is a shark going to show up in this thing? I can't handle if a shark's going to come. And sure enough, fucking shark show. Like, even like, you know, like, oh my God, the tank is stuck. And I'm like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And I'm like, huh, we're getting something big that's coming towards you. And I'm like, no, I can't. So this thing attacks you. It's a shark. And it looks kind of CG, but there is still something scary about it because you are so embedded in it. And it gets to the point where it keeps hitting you and literally the chain, the guard in front of you breaks wide open. So there's nothing protecting you. And I was like, oh my God. And thankfully, you know, I survived. I was getting ready to pull off the headphones or something. And I was like, man, I got to talk about that because that was the scariest thing I've ever, like, I can't imagine. Like, I'm all in. And he apparently told me you could do movies. You could watch movies with this thing on. Sure. But what it does is, It looks like you're in a darkened movie theater. Mm-hmm. So you see seats in front of you and stuff like that, and the movie plays like this.
How weird!
So you can literally simulate the movie theater experience, which is kind of amazing.
That's wild.
But yeah, it's pretty wild. And I texted him before to be like, hey, what was that thing you watched? And he's like, well, do you want to see video? And I was like, you fucker, you got video of me screaming? And he's like,
oh,
yep.
Oh, that's funny.
It's so wonderful.
Yes, I showed it to Becca before.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
and Rob does scream.
You could see it on the TV. What I'm seeing, you could see on the TV. Okay. So that's what makes the video fun is you could pan back and forth and you see a shark attacking me and I'm freaking out.
I wonder if they'll ever do the bodysuit so you feel it physically as well, like Lawnmower Man.
I'm sure it's coming that way.
It's got it.
Because you really do need that extra sense.
But that was enough. You know, like the way that I was seated, I felt like I was in water because the rest of your senses are so tricked,
right?
You know, that I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. But it's funny. It will tie into our guest because I had interviewed our guest for FearNet and, you know, legend in the effects world. And jokingly towards the end, he's like, look, man, I'm out of this game. He's like, now it's 3D or whatever. It's going to be VR one day. It's like, I'm going to be soaring with birds in the mountains. Yeah. And it's going to be amazing, you know? Yeah. And I'm like, holy shit. I was like, yeah, that'll never happen. And lo and behold, right before it comes on, I actually experienced that. I was like, that's crazy.
No, so. I definitely think that we are moving in that direction, especially because these home VR things like Oculus and the PlayStation 1, they have lessened in price so much just over the past couple of years, because I went to a convention a couple of years ago and we tried out the Oculus one. And at the time it was almost $1,000 and they're down to just a couple hundred. And so, yeah, it's becoming a total accessible medium.
Will that be connected to video games soon? So you'd be playing a game wearing a headset?
He already told me that he plays like the new Batman game. I was like, you get to be fucking Batman? He's like, the only thing is like, you don't get to drive the Batmobile. Like you get in it and it turns dark and then you're at your setting. And I'm like, all right, so they're one step shy, because if I get to drive and that's the thing, everyone knows how much I love the 3D setup, but this really blew me away, and I was like, oh my God.
But see, that new Friday 13th movie they're making, it'd be cool if you were in the POV shot, the killer POV of Jason.
Yeah.
That would be tight.
No, it might be a little weird.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds disturbing.
But that's what we're placed in it anyway. We can't, you know, the director puts you in it anyway, so what can you do?
Yeah.
I think that'd be interesting. I still want to play that game. I'm very interested in seeing
it. I can't wait. Yeah. So, anything we missed?
No, I think that's good.
I mean,
good segue
good.
To an FX legend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so welcome back to the interview portion of the show. And I'm very excited because I've interviewed this gentleman a few times. We've shared the stage for some panels here and there. And this book that he just released, Rubberhead, Sex, Drugs, and Special Effects, has been a long time in the making. Welcome to the show, Mr. Effects Legend, Steve Johnson.
Thank you so much. Very pleased to be here.
Yeah, man.
So let's dive into the sex.
I was more interested in the drugs.
I'm getting so much backlash. People are like, what the hell is this? I'm like, just see the title of the book. It clearly states sex, drugs, and special effects.
That's awesome.
Well, I think that it's a new world to special effects because that, like, it puts it into, like rock and roll status. So, like, special effects just got way cooler.
It does. But the thing is, back in the glory days of this industry, back in the 80s and 90s, it was like that. We were rock stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
And that's kind of the point of this book, because I'm hoping that it will serve kind of as an open window for future generations to see what those glory days were like, to really experience. It's written in real-time present tense as though you're a fly on the wall. So each chapter is kind of like a short film. So it's really exciting and it will – because, you know, nobody else would ever really prostrate themselves like this, because most other people in my position – actually care about their career.
And you know what? I mean, there's so many things I want to talk about, but well, let's go backwards. The thing about this book that I'm curious about is several years ago, you had sent me a manuscript for Rubberhead,
right.
A version of Rubberhead that was more, I guess, an autobiography by way of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. It was a very radical way of you recounting a lot of your experiences on set and stuff. So I guess my first question is how has it changed since that version you sent me? Because now this is going to be several volumes of a set and it incorporates pictures and all that stuff, whereas your first version of it was more of a narrative story that you were telling.
It was, exactly. It was originally written as a straightforward memoir,
yeah.
Kind of an Anthony Bourdain Kitchen Confidential kind of deal. And it was very long, 800 or 900 pages, because I can't ever, as you'll find out, can't possibly shut my mouth. But there's a lot to talk about. I mean, that's the other thing. So, you know, I shopped it around, and in a bizarre twist of fate, I actually got Anthony Bourdain's agent interested. Mm-hmm. And he was ruthless, and he was a hateful son of a bitch. But he shopped it around to all the big 4 or 5 publishers, got some really big interest. Ultimately, they all said, okay, wait a minute. It's not a broad enough audience appeal. But we like it. We think there's something there. But what you need to do is you need to cut out all the cool stuff. You need to cut out the Walter Mitty daydreams. You need to cut out the time travel kind of mechanism you use to join this disjointed time traveling story together. And then we'll make a deal. And I'm like, wait a minute, let me get this straight. You're asking me to literally surgically remove the heart and soul of my book. And they're like, yeah, then we have a deal. And I just couldn't do it. I wouldn't do it.
So what was left at that point that they were most attracted to? Just kind of the Hollywood tales?
I believe that there is a huge kind of nostalgia, as all three of you know right mm-hmm. now, for the kind of handmade creations and the movies that were made in the 80s
Definitely.
And 90s. I mean, everybody is hearkening back to that kind of thing right now. So there is kind of a resurgence for this kind of stuff. There's kind of a backlash against digital mm-hmm. technology. And so, yeah. And also, it's, you know, as cliche as it may sound, it's not – I didn't write it for the 10,000 horror fans and science fiction fans. I wrote it for a broader audience. I wrote it for soccer moms in New Jersey. I wrote it for lawyers in Tennessee. So I think it has a broader appeal because, you know, if you're a Michael Jackson fan, there's a huge story about working with Michael Jackson in here. We've got Robin Williams. There's so many stars. So there's a lot of stuff to be attracted to. But ultimately, everyone passed on it. And I would have made a deal had I destroyed it. And I didn't want to do that. And so ultimately, I decided that the best thing, you know, the old adage, if you can't beat them, join them, because what the kids want are the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many illiterate people out there. Sorry, you fans. Sorry, all you horror fans. But there are. They just want the pictures. And so a lot of people, I'm quite certain, will buy this book for the pictures and the captions. And it's loaded with pictures. It's kind of interesting in that it's a half memoir, half art book. And so in order to fit all the photos in, we split it up into 5 volumes, and that's what we're holding in our hands right now. Volume 1, half memoir, half art book. And so the story is split between the 5 volumes as well as the pictures.
Oh, right. My gosh. There's 5 this thick?
That's right.
That's an amazing amount of pictures that you've collected over the years.
Oh, my God. There could be 10 or 15 volumes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Well, I mean, come on. I did over a couple hundred films. I did all the greatest hits of the 80s, from Fright Night to Big Trouble in Little China. I mean, there's so much to talk about. And music videos, animatronics, I mean, you name it, television shows. So there's a lot there. And luckily, I must have had some kind of foresight all those years back, because I always have had my own personal photographer who documented every step of every creation we ever made, with both videotape tests and photographs. So I've got a huge archive to draw from.
Impressive.
Never before seen stuff. It's amazing. I mean, the Predator stuff alone, my failed Predator, people are losing their minds over that.
Yeah, I did an article that I sent to him about the I guess you were on some interview show where you talked about the Van Damme stuff, and it's just gold. But and also lately a lot of these Scream Factory releases, they're now doing these great Blu-ray releases of everything, and I get very excited when you pop up, because you're the most candid, straightforward. I think I was telling them that Species 2 is like my favorite interview, because it runs and then the credits go, and literally at the tail end you're like, okay, I think I offended Geiger, Frank Mikuza. Yep, covered them all.
Oh, goddamn. You know, here's the thing. I haven't seen any of those. I know that, I don't know, they're going to run out at some point. But like I said, there's a nostalgia for this kind of stuff, and they just contacted me to do Species 1, and I can't wait to do that one.
Yeah, that's going to be fun. So I want to go back a little bit to kind of, as you put it, the glory days, the rock and roll days of being an effects artist, because the way that I discovered you, I really tried to pinpoint as a kid where my interest in effects came. And really, I think for a lot of us, it boiled down to Michael Jackson's Thriller and the making of Thriller. Because right. the making of Thriller as a kid for me was the first time I was physically able to see somebody like Rick Baker making effects. I'm like, wow, that's how it's done. But to me, one of the most indelible things, and I sent them the video of this, is watching the Horror Hall of Fame, and you had your scare tactics with Linnea.
Lord.
But here's the thing.
This is why, you know, as you can witness with that book, I've never been afraid to make a complete jackass of myself.
But those were great, because I remember a specific scare tactics episode where you guys made monster teeth out of, like, now and laters, and then your thumb
the candy
blew up.
And stuff. Yeah.
Chewy
and
fruit candy.
Chewy fruit
which
candy.
I couldn't say Starburst, so it had to be.
Chewy fruit candy.
And I tried it at home. And
it works.
And it did. It totally worked.
That's the thing. It was the first thing I saw that as a kid, because, you know, you see the effects things like, well, I don't know how I could ever get in a room. Like Rick Baker with all the stuff, but seeing scare tactics was the first time as a kid that it dawned on me, oh, I could do this with just stuff. Like,
well, that's really funny, and that's nice to hear because I was crucified for those from within the industry. People are like, you're making a fool of all of us, but maybe part of it was just jealousy because they weren't up on the screen.
I was curious. I mean, because for you, I know Rick Baker was one of your mentors, and for him, it was, you know,
Dick Smith.
What I mean, were people in the effects industry, especially when you're getting in, were they open to sharing kind of their quote unquote secrets and how they did stuff and that, or was there a level of competition in terms of how to pull this stuff off?
In the late 70s, early 80s, there was still a huge level of competition, and I won't mention the gentleman, the five-time Oscar winner gentleman's name with whom I did my first movie, but he used to lock me out of his garage where we were working on the first film so he could use carcinogenic materials to remove seams so that I wouldn't know how to do it. So he was doing like low-paid menial labor by himself with carcinogens instead of having his intern do it so I wouldn't know how to remove seams.
Right.
That's how bad it was back then.
Wow. So, I mean, who gave you
He would have rather caught cancer than teach me how to remove seams.
So, I mean, I'm always curious of that because, again, that opened up a whole world seeing you do Scream Tactics and what's the Savini special that
we were watching recently on the Fangos, yeah.
The Scream Greats. The video of that. I mean, for kids of my age that were growing up in that era, it was just opening up a whole world to us. What was it for you? Was it like Famous Monster magazines and stuff like that? Like, how do you get to figure out how to do this stuff?
Well, it was, you know, that when people ask me that, I always say, this is always my answer. People ask Stephen King the same question. Why do you write? And his answer is always the same. Because I simply can't not write. Mm-hmm. And I somehow came out of the womb with this insane desire to create strange, offbeat, macabre creations. I mean, since I was literally in kindergarten, I wanted to make, you know, take coffee cans and make Indian totem poles out of them with construction paper, and very attracted to anything from Hammer, anything from Universal. And so it was a natural progression to say, how did they do that? Mm-hmm. But, you know, back then in the 60s, growing up in Texas, there was no Stan Winston School of Character Arts. There was no Tom Savini, you know, School of Makeup Effects. There was no way to learn at all. I mean, I would force my mother to drive me to Galveston and search through the moat-filled slanting sunbeams for books on mold making or anything, makeup. But there weren't. The best I could find was a book on death casting. And so I almost killed my best friend when I was 12. Like, well, it can't be that different than for light casting. Can't be that different.
Cover up those nostrils. You're fine.
So basically what I did is I had to teach myself.
Right.
Which I think there's a lot to be said for that. Because what that does, as opposed to going to a school and being spoon-fed the information, it teaches you to be a problem solver when you have to figure it out on your own. And that, to me, is the single most important aspect of this business. Because if somebody... You can develop talent by practice. You can develop sculpture. You can learn mold making techniques, casting and painting techniques. But, you know, if the creative process, if someone comes to you and says, I want this vampire to deteriorate in this movie, sure, you can figure out a way to do that. And then 2 years later, they come back and say, hey, I want you to make a vampire turn to ash again when the sun hits him. You really don't want to do it the same way twice. You want to inspire yourself first because you know if you live, breathe, sleep, eat, and dream this stuff, if you can make yourself excited, then you can be goddamn sure the audience is going to be excited. Yeah. So it's really all about trying to keep yourself excited and figuring out new ways and innovative techniques, which sadly is kind of, you know, to had a big chunk taken out of it when digital technology reared its hideous head and started stomping its hobnailed boots over our entire industry.
Oh, my God. I don't know if I want to jump there, but the
don't do it. Don't do it.
Let's hold on that for a bit.
Well,
let's
it's only because...
Now, we only have an hour here. Fuck that one.
But I remember something from the first draft of your book when it was still a book. It was
when it was still a book?
Oh, well, no. I mean, it's still a...
You put it on the cover.
When it was a memoir, forgive me, that I just remember sticking with me was the beautiful surreal nature of you explaining... I think you were kind of illustrating in a way the moment your heart broke was maybe it was on Blade 2 or is a Del Toro movie where you were created this thing and then it came up like well maybe we can do this digitally.
The
way you described it was like I could feel your heartbreak,
right?
Because you really went into detail about it. And I don't know if that's in here.
It is in Volume 1. It's a chapter titled "It All Started on My Birthday When the Dog Exploded." Part 1. And it not only covers what happened on Blade 2, it also covers Dreamcatcher and Magnolia. And there were three jobs in succession where I had huge contracts, huge multi-million dollar contracts, and gradually they got whittled down by, surprisingly, on all three projects by Industrial Light and Magic, the demons at Industrial Light and Magic. And ended up being virtually all of my work replaced digitally for no good goddamn reason.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. You'll have to buy a copy of the book. Okay. Everybody's getting sad now.
No.
Let me just say this real quickly here. The book is actually upbeat. And first and foremost, it's fucking funny. And all the reviews I'm getting from people are like, I don't think that they're not thinking it's funny, but they're neglect. I think they just know me and they know the tone of my voice. It's really funny. Yeah. So when I say that, you know, the sequential thing of Dreamcatcher, Blade 2, and Magnolia, it's put in a hysterically, like a sitcom, funny way.
Right.
So, you know, you got to laugh at your tragedy.
Which volume is Sybil Danning? Volume 3, I'm predicting.
That's going to be a whole volume,
because I'm
right?
waiting.
And you asked why it was 5 volumes. I didn't even cover Sybil.
Yeah.
Oh. 6 volume coming.
Now, knowing...
Volume 6 is just
Sybil.
Sybil
Danning. Just coming on Sybil. Here we go.
Hey. Oh, take it easy. You're okay. You're all right.
I'm jumping ahead to what would probably be towards the end, but I'm curious now. So knowing how the industry has advanced and where we are now, where the majority...
Advanced?
I will say how it has progressed.
Evolved.
How about that?
Let's call it evolved.
Do you think devolved. It is still possible to do a full practical movie, like in this current market?
I do. And I think more so than ever now, because if someone had the balls to go out there and say, we're going to do another John Carpenter's The Thing, and they hired me or the right person or got Bottin out of retirement, it would be amazing. And people would respond really, really well to it. The problem with it, it's twofold. It's not economically feasible so much, because it's simply cheaper to do things digitally these days. And secondly, the thing about, because I'm working on a new project right now, and the design process is, oh God, I shouldn't even, my director might hear this podcast. the design process is excruciating. I mean, we basically have to build the thing in 3D, 50,000 versions of 50. But before we, and I'm like, why can't we just start sculpting it and do a makeup test? It'll take less time, less money. But people want to see a finished product now before they get started. And it's the same thing with digital effects in movies, because when you create something practically, here's the opportunity that the director gets. When he says action, and then when he says cut, that's it. They can't fuck with it anymore. But when you create that shot and insert it digitally, they can fuck with it right up to answer print. Mm-hmm. And so it gives them so much more of a feeling of control, but also loses the fluidity of pure H.R. Giger vomiting Jackson Pollock art, where you just get something out of your head and you just excite the hell out of somebody because you've got so many fingers on it, you know.
And we talked about that. It grounded the movies. There's something we always talked about, like even the worst rubber costume you could come up with, even like a lizard man thing that pops up, there's something that makes you want to still believe versus a digital version of that, which it creates that uncanny valley.
Yeah.
And you don't believe it at all and you're out. So my question is, like, who the fuck likes, like, besides the cost, does anyone actually like the digital effects? Like, is anyone in the studio going, oh, because I actually like it more? Or is it purely cost?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. And a lot of people were saying the same thing about the new Star Wars thing where they had, you know, de-aged Carrie Fisher and brought what's-his-name back to life.
What's these, his name? These what, people, this is a Hammer fan saying, what's his name?
What's his name? Gushy.
Whatever. But listen, you feel free to fill in his name.
Okay.
But the thing is, they do it because they can.
Right.
And it's progressing the art. Mm-hmm. And so you can bitch about the Uncanny Valley and right. you can say this and that. But listen, I'm not I'm all for it because of the following thought. Digital technology is the vein through which the future of entertainment will flow. There's no doubt about
right,
that. And we can
off,
bitch yeah. and bitch and bitch about it now, but you give me a pair of those goggles, I'll never take them off. You right. know? I mean, who knows? I mean, 100 short years ago, Edison came up with his kinetoscope and you'd have to crank it, right?
Yeah.
And they had these magic candle things that delighted families for hours. And they were just
so
two
tropes,
pictures
yeah.
sliding in front of glass in front of a candle flame. So who knows what entertainment will be in the next 10 years, 20, 100. But I guarantee you it's gonna rely on digital technology. So we're in a transitional period right now. So mm-hmm. I can't really bitch about it. I mean, it's not just my business. Everybody's business is getting changed and altered. Mm-hmm. And it's given me a chance to kind of back off and, you know, pick and choose my projects and do other things like go have sex with hookers in Costa Rica for a year and live in a treehouse.
Is that in the book?
Absolutely. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Volume one.
Hookers in Costa Rica. Do you qualify under that?
Oh my God! Well, I
sold.
I have like a. I guess I don't know if this is a weird question, but well, let's start here. Where? What was the first movie or gig that you got that you felt was your big break? Like, all right, this is it. I'm actually doing this professionally now.
Good question. Interesting question. I could answer that in so many ways. So let me just make something up.
Sure.
I worked for Greg Canham. Mm-hmm. Rob Bottin and Rick Baker for the first 4 or 5 years of my career on some huge hits like The Howling American Werewolf, blah, 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 Videodrome, a bunch of stuff. But then after spending a year in London on Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan with Rick, we came back to the States and Richard Edlund from ILM had just come down and opened up his own facility, the Boss Film Corporation, where he wanted to do something pretty unique. He not only wanted to do optical effects, there was no such thing as digital then, but he wanted, you know, sound stages. He wanted to do pyrotechnics. He wanted to do the models. And he wanted to build the creatures. So he wanted to make this big umbrella kind of corporation. And he asked Rick if he wanted to come over to work on a little film called Ghostbusters. And Rick said, took a look at the script. He goes, this is bullshit. I've got my own thing going. I'm tired. I've just gotten back from England. And plus, he was really, really sick of working with me. It had been a long, long 3 years. So in order to get me away from him, he goes, why don't you call up this young kid called Steve Johnson? And so I went down there and met with Richard. And in the, you know, those days, Randy Cook and I, who's now a 3-time Oscar winner himself for visual effects on sequentially for the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Yeah, yeah. Love Randy.
Yeah, Randy and I headed up the Ghost Shop for years and did all the greatest hits of the 80s there. And we're fired from some of the greatest hits of the 80s, including Lost Boys and Predator. But the thing is, just, you know, it was the first, I mean, I had an umbrella. I had a safety net because Richard handled the numbers. He brought the jobs in. And then he just said, go play. Hire as many people as you want. Do whatever you want. I'm not even going to look over your shoulder unless I happen to stagger into the studio one night at 2 a.m. drunk. That story's in there, too, for Ghostbusters. But it was just amazing. I remember walking around, you know, the sound stages and running my team. I had 150 people working, and it was me. It was my ideas finally getting up on screen. And that was absolute magic for me. It was amazing. So that was, I think, when I first thought, okay, I made it. I'm doing my own thing. I'm getting my own ideas up on screen. I'm not working under the shadow of Bottin or Baker anymore. And it was really, really a beautiful time.
And you're 23?
Something like that.
23
now,
years old. That's
since this was kind of your first time kind of swimming solo on it, what was the one effect in Ghostbusters that when you first read the script, you were like, I'm going to have to give this one a thought? Like, what was the one that kind of gave you pause that you had to figure out how to do it?
Well, since Randy and I split it up, I mean, Randy's a great stop motion animator before digital animation. Now he's a great digital animator. So he took on the Terror Dogs and we just like threw cards out and said, okay, you do Slimer, you do the Terror Dogs, you do the Librarian Ghost. All of it. What I wanted to do is I wanted to take everything that I had ever learned from the other people I'd worked with, masters like Canham, Bottin, and Baker, and one up them. I wanted to shove what I was doing down their fucking throats. And so I kind of took everything I learned from them, but then I twisted it and used very unique alternative ideas to get the stuff up on screen. So I have no idea if I answered your question.
I'll take it.
All of Ghostbusters.
I think the librarian was one of the
first. I feel like Donald Trump here.
The librarian's one of the first things that would have scared the shit out of me in a theater. That would be one of the earliest films I would have seen as a kid. In that moment,
there's some scary stuff in
fucking
that.
Scary when you're
The librarian, definitely. I remember my parents getting that on VHS and that being like one of the first like startling moments of my childhood.
I didn't know until today. I watched that one of the videos on your channel. I didn't know that about the Belushi being sculpted as Slimer. I had no idea. And when I read that, it made the whole thing make sense.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's why he has so much character. That's why people love Slimer, is because they also love Belushi.
That's funny that you mentioned. There's a hysterical story about the creation of Slimer in Volume 1 here. And it kind of goes into one of those Walter Mitty daydreams where, and it's all based on fact, right, where I'm, you know, I've got my big approval deadline after I've done 50,000 versions, small models, full-size models, blah, blah, blah. And people are coming in saying, I don't know, there's something wrong with his nose. I'm like, well, what do you want it bigger? Sure, make it bigger. They come back and say, the nose is too big. Well, maybe you should put ears on him the next meeting. Take his ears off. Give him more pathos, less pathos. Make him older, younger, wilder, calmer, more cartoony, less cartoony. It was a trial by fire learning how to do that. So in the story, to kind of make the point of the approval process, I'm doing a bunch of blow at 3 a.m., which I was, trying to finish this to make my deadline for the next day. And I John Belushi's ghost shows up to help me finish the sculpture. It's one of those Walter Mitty things. And it's really funny. He shows up to model for me and he tries to do a line of cocaine, but he's a ghost and it just travels through.
That's actually really cool. I'm actually pretty jazzed to read this now.
Let's party!
Was the characterization and kind of the pathos that was Slimer, was that dictated in the script, or did you have to do a lot of that when you were doing the character design?
No, it was all about the character design. I mean, at that point, it was just a flying green blob.
Yeah.
And he was not even called Slimer. He was called Onion Head in the script.
So you made the character that ultimately kind of became the most endearing thing about the franchise.
A refrigerator magnet, a coffee cup, a fizzy fruit drink,
cartoon.
Toothpaste, a Saturday morning. Yeah, you name it. Yeah, and I didn't make a goddamn. I spent money because I was doing so much coke to sculpt it. It cost me money, and I didn't get a penny in royalties.
Oh, my God.
Now, where is the original Slimer now? Did he, like, end up in Bob's basement or?
God only knows. I haven't even seen that resurface anywhere on auction sites or anything. I mean, it was made of foam rubber, so it's probably long ago deteriorated.
Yeah. I've got a two-part question for you. What – because I know one answer that this
– Wait a minute, guys. It was the 80s. It was the early 80s. I was not the only person doing cocaine back then.
No, judge. Don't judge me.
Don't judge me.
No, it makes a lot of sense. My two-part question is this. What was a job that you worked on that you were either – thinking when you did it, like, this is not going to work, that ended up becoming kind of iconic, and then vice versa, something that you really were proud of that didn't really have an impact. And the example I know is, I know you've said a lot that you were never happy with the smiling vampire in Fright Night that ended up being the fucking poster.
Yeah,
which is
exactly.
Beautiful.
So I don't know if that would be the case of something that you're like, this is just terrible, and then it ends up becoming well celebrated, and then
so many things. You never know how audiences are going to respond to things, but also it has to do with how the director, you know, cuts them in, and the editing, and the lighting, and the performances. There's just so much stuff. I mean, on The Abyss, which is probably one of my most proudest achievements, doing the underwater sea aliens, non-terrestrial intelligences. You know, I would just lay in my office day after day, just trying to come up with the least painful method of suicide techniques, or at least hoping James Cameron would send a kind-hearted hitman, because that job was virtually impossible. I mean, when I went down and met James, he said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to create the single most ethereal creature that's ever been put on film. I want it to be glass clear. I want it to light up and change colors like a goddamn Las Vegas sign, and I want to actually shoot it underwater. And he goes, can you do it? And I said, sure. Having no clue if it was possible. And it really wasn't possible back then. These days it would be easier because, of course, number one, they'd do it digitally.
Yeah.
But you know, back then there was no digital fallback. So, I mean, this was all on me. Because in the climax of that film you couldn't see these aliens, what could they have possibly done? Cancel the film, hire another? I mean, it happened on Close Encounters. I mean, they had a huge issue with the aliens then, and they kind of shut down and restarted up with another artist. But, you know, I really didn't want that on my record. So we made it work with James' help, and I'm really, really pleased with this. And I'm absolutely certain I didn't answer your question.
But I'm cutting in with a new one. What were the aliens ultimately made of? Because they look so jellyfish-like.
They were made of the clearest urethane we could find at the time. I mean, now we've got super flexible glass clear urethanes, but we don't really want to talk about technical stuff, do we?
I'm interested, but we'll go in a different direction.
What?
And then, you know, then we lit them up with fiber optics, and you got your shot.
How big were they?
I'm going to kill you.
He's
got a YouTube channel for that.
Yeah. He explains it all on YouTube.
Okay. I can lead this into an entertaining story. I'm going to work with you now. We made them half scale. They were supposed to be slightly over 8 feet tall, so we made them at 4 feet because we shot them, you know, in a huge water tank against nothing that you could relate them to. But then we had to have an interactive full-scale puppet when Ed Harris takes it by the hand and they start to swim around. I wasn't contracted to make a full-scale one. So James said, well, look, you're building all these half-scale ones, but just give me – I need this shot. I need a full-scale arm so Ed Harris can touch him. And I'd like to get a piece of the alien's head in that. So I shoot over Ed's shoulder. So just make a half – can you just make a half one? And I'm like, your wife, Gail Hurd, has already fucking set me on fire and burned an effigy of me because I've already gone over budget on this night. And he goes, it's just a half an alien. Don't worry about it. Throw it in. Because you work on a fixed budget on these things, right? You want to make the director happy. You want to get their next job. So I make a half an alien, which meant a whole new sculpture, whole new set of molds, whole new set of engineering. Get it down to set. James is setting up the shot with Ed Harris in this 3 billion gallon water tank. And it looks fucking amazing. The alien's changing colors. Ed's in there. The fingers are stretching and wrapping around Ed's hand. And James is getting, as he tends to do, increasingly more and more agitated. And finally, he's like, fuck, 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 fuck. And I'm like, what? What's the matter? The shot looks great. And he goes, God damn it, that's what's wrong with it. It looks too good. He goes, it looks so good, I want to pull wider. And I'm like, but you said just make a half an alien. He goes, God damn it, Steve, do yourself a favor. Next time you make half an alien, make a whole one.
How did that, of all the movies you worked on, because I saw your post where you're talking about the Oscars, how did that movie not win the Oscar? Like, what could have possibly come out that year? Because
it did win the Oscar.
No, but the Oscar for effects.
Yes, it did win. And why didn't I get one? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, we'll have to call up James. Can you get him?
That
was the thing. When we were doing that Ed Harris shot, he let me direct it. You know, after he was fine with how he goes, hi, I got three more sets going on. You make your Oscar on this. Uh-huh. But then that goddamn water tentacle came into play. And that was one of the first times people saw this amazing digital thing that blew their fucking minds. Uh-huh. So it took all the aliens' glory.
Interesting.
So, you know, you can only put 4 people up for the – and it kills me. I lose sleep over that to this day.
I mean, you just take heart. That's amazing work. What's the deal? I'm imagining when you work with first time or early directors who haven't done a lot of effects heavy stuff, that you have to really teach them a lot of how to even shoot your work.
Yeah.
What are some examples where you've had to really walk people through how to? Because I imagine a lot of people haven't got any experience shooting practical effects when they first.
This is what happens. I mean, as you get older in this business, you go into meetings and you have more and more confidence because the people you're meeting with are, you know, gradually get younger and younger.
Yeah.
It's a young person's business, right? So, yeah, it gets difficult when, like right now, I'm doing a line of Slimer products and I was just talking to him on the phone on the way down here that I'm doing a librarian and a Slimer for them. And they're telling me what it should look like. And I'm like, you weren't even born when this movie came out. Why are you telling me what this thing should look like? You need to read the book. You're trying to get me to insult directors.
No. Don't talk about the bit. No, I actually am genuinely interested because I imagine most filmmakers, if they haven't made an effects heavy film, if they inherit a film like that, they wouldn't have a clue of how to actually stage it without knowing how best to shoot it from your perspective.
In my opinion, there are two types of directors. There's the type that hires you because they like your work. Like if you went to an art gallery and you wanted to buy a Van Gogh or a Monet, you're like, wow, I like this style, so I'm not going to fuck with this guy too much.
So there's they would let type. You direct those parts?
They would let us. They would listen to us. We would go shoulder to shoulder in the trenches and make the goddamn shit and shoot it the way it should be. We would collaborate.
Right.
And then there's another kind of director, the kind that jumps up and down on your neck until your eyeballs fucking pop out of your head and you vomit blood. And they just keep wanting change after change after change after change because, you know, it's dangerous. A little bit of knowledge is dangerous, I think, because sometimes they think they know what's happening and how to do it and how to shoot it. And sometimes it's easier to work with someone who doesn't know what, you know, what the hell's going on.
Right.
But, you know, if there's anything I've learned throughout my very storied career, it's that, you know what? For instance, John Carpenter on Big Trouble in Little China, I fought him tooth and nail through the whole thing. It's going to be in volume two, and he's going to fucking hate me for the way he comes off in this. But if there's anything I've learned, it's that, guess what? The director is always right. And it's the thing that you'll find in all these five volumes is that I have fought and clawed and just scratched at every director who's ever told me how to do something, because I've always thought, no, this is my stuff. These are my creations. Don't you tell me how to do this stuff. But you know what? It's like if I went in to get a haircut and I said, well, a little short on the back and sides, leave it a little long in the front. And they said, yeah, you know what? I'm not going to do it that way. It'd be like that, right? Because I've had that happen, right. And it kind of helped me understand that it is their film. But, you know, we were just racing back then. We were all full of ourselves, egotistical, megalomaniacs, maniacs. And we were really, I think, the Bakers and the Botines and the Canhams and me and Winston back in those days, we were working more to impress each other and to compete with each other than we were for what was on the script.
That's pretty rad.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, you know, great. You gave me the money. I'll just keep you a little happy. But what I really want to do is show Winston how good I am, which is, you know, it's a little bit healthy and also a little bit dangerous.
Whose stuff turned you on the most during that period? I mean, even whether you worked with them or not, whose stuff were you always inspired by?
Well, I mean, it started out with Dick Smith, Little Big Man. Uh-huh. I mean, I just couldn't believe that. I was probably 14 when I saw that movie, and I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah, Arthur
Penn. I'd never seen anything like that. You know, Dustin Hoffman is a 120-year-old man. Yeah. It was just flawless, unbelievable. And, you know, Planet of the Apes came out within, you know, a year or two of that, and I saw that, and I'm like, well, they just look like masks. Mm. The edges are invisible, but that started a lot of people's career, Planet of the Apes, but it didn't do much for me. But Little Big Man did, but even... You know, being 14 years old, I'm like, why the hell didn't they just hire a real old man? This is just kind of a show-offy thing, isn't it, at this point? But that's what really got me started, and that's what really inspired me. Then I was led directly to Rick Baker, because what inspired me about Rick Baker, as opposed to Jack Pierce, who's, you know, responsible for all the classic Universal things, Frankenstein, The Wolfman, The Mummy, and John Chambers, the Planet of the Apes guy, what inspired me about Rick is that he was a young kid with long hair forging his way in California, and that appealed to me, and I related to that. And so Rick became my god and my idol, and that's why I was magnetically drawn to him, and that's why he started giving me my start in the industry. Hmm. But, you know, since then, I've tried to follow in Botine's steps more than Rick's, because Botine took a lot of chances. I'd like to think I do too. And while Baker's work is unbelievably photorealistic and fantastic and probably the best that's ever been done, it's safe, and that doesn't excite me as much as just wildly taking chances that could possibly crash and burn.
Like quite surreal, like Botine, some of that stuff, and the thing is
look at
actually
this thing.
Surreal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unbelievable, and all of that stuff was a quarter inch from being a disaster.
Yeah.
One of the things I didn't even know about recently on both the Species 2 disc and I believe the one that just came out, Poltergeist 2, as a kid, I didn't realize Geiger's involvement at all in those things. He did a lot of the designs. And you talked briefly on the Blu-rays of it that he was kind of a hero to you, or at least somebody that you admired. Did you get to spend any time with Geiger and actually work with him?
Because
I can only imagine how weird and surreal that would be. Well, what was that like?
Okay, well, since the poor man is dead, I can say anything I want now without fear of retribution.
he is now gone.
Geiger is the ultimate taskmaster. He's the ultimate artist's artist. He's never satisfied. I mean, if you take a look at – this is why he was so hands-on in the original Alien, Ridley Scott's Alien, because he doesn't trust anybody. Mm. He wants to do it all himself. And he's been famously vocal about being disappointed with virtually every movie he's worked with an effects company on. So the first thing was Poltergeist 2 that I worked with him on, and he hated our work in it. You know, he actually did fly out to Los Angeles for a period of about a week. And the first thing he asked me is if he knew where I could get him any opium.
Wow.
I've heard that, yeah.
What do you think fueled all those the incredible intricacy? I mean, you've got to be so focused to be able to do what he was doing at the heyday of his career.
Was opium a thing in the 80s in L.A.?
No, Switzerland, evidently. Sure. In Switzerland it was. And then, remember, MDMA was legal back then, so he like gave the entire crew at Boss Film Corporation pure ecstasy. And we had never done it before. And he actually gave us like a handwritten Xerox notes on what to expect, how to do it. And it was really, really interesting.
Wow, he's like an expert on this.
You got to print those notes in your book.
He's carrying around the notes.
Oh my God, I wish I still had that.
Geiger's Guide to Ecstasy. Oh, that's crazy.
You know, so I thought that Poltergeist 2 went okay, but he hated it. And then he became very vocal about it when he started doing interviews later. And then we got the opportunity to work with him on Species, the first Species. And I thought, you know what? The poor guy has hated every film. You know, people rip him off constantly, and he's just miserable. And I'm going to listen to him this time. I'm going to make him happy. I'm going to do whatever it takes on Species. And what it took, he just wanted to be heard. But the problem with listening to H.R. Giger is the time difference, and he's also nocturnal. So, you know, he would call me up in the middle of a work day when it's the middle of the night there, and he's just shot himself up or done a hit of ecstasy or whatever he's done, and he would want to talk for hours and hours and hours and hours. And it got to the point where I wouldn't take his calls. I'm just like, can you imagine? We get to a point where you won't. My receptionist like, Giger, don't tell him I'm not here. Tell him my mom died. Tell him it's a national holiday. Tell him anything. Just get him off the phone. So my assistant ultimately had to listen to him because he just wanted to talk to somebody.
Oh my God.
And her volume's coming out soon.
Her book on Giger. Yeah.
I want to hear that.
And this is one of the funny things about Giger. He would, he would spend hours drawing scathing cartoons of like Frank Mancuso, the producer, right, with like Syl, the alien from Species, raping him in the ass. But when he got mad at people, he would draw these horrific pornographic, and then the fax was constantly going of cartoons coming in of Giger just hating people.
Quite a legend.
On these hour-long calls, like, what was he like to talk with? Was he as genius as I would hope he would be, or did it flow more like stream of conscious where you couldn't exactly follow what he was talking about a lot of it?
It was kind of like that. Here's an example in Species 1. I don't know if you remember Michelle what's her name that plays the young Syl?
Michelle Williams.
In the beginning of that scene, when she first goes into her cocoon, all these tentacles are meant to burst out of her face and arms and pull her up into a cocoon where she transforms into Natasha, the sexy version, the older version. And so he's like, they must be looking like pickles. Pickles, we must put pickles from cheeks, from necks. Pickles, I say.
Pickles?
I'm like, all right.
Pickles. Like Monster from Beach Party or something.
Pickles. Mean pickles?
I don't. Well, no, he didn't. But then, you know, we do our test. He's like, what is this? They look like pickles. I'm like, right. You said you wanted pickles to come out of it. Pimples. He meant pimples. Popping pimples. So yeah,
that's pretty
tough.
Well, let me try.
Did you replace the pickles with the pimples?
Certainly not. But then, in any case, we moved on to Species 2. So he was happy with that. And the reason he was happy with Species 1 was because I listened to him. And that's an important lesson to learn. But on Species 2, when we came around to that one, he just could not get his contract negotiated with the studio. And I'm sitting there with a contingent of producers, armed producers with guns pointing at me saying, we have a shoot date. You've got to get this stuff done. You're on a fixed budget. Go. And I'm like, but Giger hasn't approved any designs yet because he hasn't signed his contract and he won't send me anything. And they're like, we don't care. We don't care. We're stamping his name on this project. You make whatever the fuck you want. So I start building shit. Giger-esque shit. What I thought Giger would do is what so many people do when they rip him off anyway, right? Mm. Just don't put his name on it, but they just do it Giger-esque. Oh my God, it was a disaster. Because he did actually fly out for a couple of days and raped me. I mean, he was so angry with what we're doing. He wanted us to start over. And I'm like, Hans, you're going back to stagger around your castle in the Alps and do whatever you do. Mm. And I've got to have something on set. I can't start over. And I remember sitting on set when we were working with the Patrick Beast, this huge monster we made for that, the kind of male version of Syl, the female one. And I'm sitting in my director's chair next to Frank Mancuso's, and Frank's not there. The guys are set up a shot. I'm like, and I look in the little pouch in the side, and there's like a big stack of memos from Giger. And I'm like, God damn it, I'm pulling that out. And so I pulled out this stack, and it was a fax from Giger insulting me. And there was a cartoon drawn on me, too. It was something like, we can't use the Patrick. It looks like a fag parade at Mardi Gras.
Oh, God.
That's a souvenir to keep.
We were already shooting it. It was too late. No wonder Frank didn't show it to me.
Wow. My favorite thing about Species 2, which I've mentioned, is the... I guess they interview the screenwriter on that disc too, and he talks about the ending
Dennis
and
Feldman.
How that ending came together.
Oh no, Species too. Chris, yeah. Chris, who?
Yeah,
Chris somebody.
I've heard his name. He didn't. But the ending, the way that the ending came together, because it was one of those things where everybody had an idea.
Oh, like, I didn't see that. Did he insult me because I ended up?
No, not at all.
Peter Medak, the director on that, even got mad at me because I basically just storyboarded the whole scene and said, "This is what we're going to shoot." And Peter Medak was like, we're really good friends. We maintained a friendship. But he's like, I remember overhearing him one day. I was walking out of set, and he was yelling at Frank Mancuso when we were shooting the ending. He's like, Steve Johnson will not direct my film.
Amazing. You know, one of the things that impresses me about a lot of the videos that you put out on YouTube a couple years ago, because you documented – actually, a lot of the effects guys in the 80s tend to film everything, all the work that you
video tests, yeah, you have to.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's – your level of skill set in various types of effects and animatronics and things like that, like off the top of my head, some of the superhero stuff you did was, I thought, was bordering on revolutionary. The Incredible Hulk physically transforming, the Superman Lives costume like lighting up. This is some pretty amazing stuff. So I always feel like you were kind of evolving with stuff, you know, with the changes and trying new things. At that period where it was shifting from physical to digital and trying to do both, I mean, did you have an interest in the digital side of things, at least on a design level, or did that never, did the digital stuff never really interest you?
Never interested me, but I wasn't stupid. I could see the writing on the wall, so I did kind of experiment. I hired a digital team. We did a whole lot of stuff, and we got contracts in, and we did some really cool stuff, but by blending.
Mm-hmm. Because that's the best way.
Yeah. But, you know, I found that there was no money to be made in it, and it just didn't excite me. I mean, there's where you could just get change after. Look at what happened to the Rhythm and Use that went bankrupt after Life of Pi, after they won an Oscar. Yeah. Because you can't, it's like the director's jumping up and down in your throat until you vomit blood and your eyes pop out. They can keep making you change, and you can't really say, well, you didn't say it was only 3 changes. It was 5, 10, 15, whatever you want. I'm happy you want to do their next job. So I didn't really enjoy the digital thing at all. But I will tell you that the thing that I do like about digital effects is the blending, the way Guillermo del Toro does it a lot of times. It's really magical, and people are starting to actually take his lead and do it, because what that does is it brings back that wow factor. It brings back to the audience who's paying to see the movie, how did they do that? Because when you create an effect, when you create a practical effect, I liken it to a magic trick. Like when you go see a magician pull a rabbit out of his hat, you know he's not pulling the rabbit out of his hat, but it involves you because you're like, how the hell did he do that? So when you see a full-on practical effect, you go, how the hell did they do that? But since those aren't done so much anymore, the only way to really pull that wow factor and make the audience feel involved is to blend the two at this point, I think. Because the audiences are pretty savvy, and I think they generally know at this point that something's digital, and I don't think it's quite as involving for them. Mm. You can certainly do stuff you can't do practically, no question. But when you blend the two, I mean, we say this now, in 10 years, we'll all be robots with those goggles and it'll be all over.
I said that in the first half of our show. No. Somebody gave me their VR experience to try, where they dunked me into a tank where a shark came at me. And I was like, it was the scariest thing I've ever seen, because you're immersed in it. You have your headphones on. You really feel like you're there.
Right.
And kind of like a little off because you feel like you're in water and stuff like that. So, and he said that he can watch movies with it in a way that simulates being in a theater, where the screen's in front of you and there's seats and everything, and it feels like you're in a theater. So, I don't know. That doesn't sound that bad compared to, you know, other things that would, you know, happen in technology.
But some of the magic is kind of gone, because, I mean, I remember as being a kid in the 80s, this is why I'm here. I would watch movies like this and then immediately go, how did they do that? And then I'd beg my mom until she took me to Walden Books to buy the Fangoria magazine about it, so I could learn how they did it. But now when I see something like Crimson Peak, since you mentioned Del Toro, or any other contemporary films where they do have creatures, I don't ask that question anymore. Right. I just immediately go, oh, it's digital.
You just assume it is, even if it's not. And that was one of the worst things. I mean, the reward to me always was not working with the directors or doing the sculpture or the paint job or coming up with the ideas necessarily. In the heyday, the reward to me was sitting in a theater and watching the audience gasp. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I had made them go, holy hell, how the hell was that done? But then as it started to evolve, if I did get the opportunity to pull off something truly groundbreaking practically, people would just assume it was done digitally anyway, and it ruined the whole shtick for me. Mm-hmm.
And have you kept up with, do you keep up on, I know that you're obviously love writing and that's kind of the thing that you focus on, but do you keep up with modern movies, modern horror? Has there been anything of late that's excited you in the same way that maybe while you were?
No, not at all. I have a huge,
there's a robot attacking.
Probably the
digital
wrong
effect.
Probably the wrong place to say this, but I have an aversion to modern horror films. Mm-hmm. They don't do anything for me. They all seem derivative of each other. It's very rare. But I'll tell you what I do like. I mean, let's think. The most recent movie I saw a couple of months ago that really was a transformative film experience for me that I feel was kind of a horror film was Favreau's Jungle Book.
Mm. Oh, wow.
I mean, it was amazing pretty, and yeah. unique and just outrageous. I mean, the kid was – they spent all this money on the designs and everything, the production design, the digital creations, which were astounding, the voice actors. Mm. Who didn't say get that kid out of here? He's awful.
he is
so bad.
The one thing.
It virtually
he's
ruins the
movie.
He's
the one real thing in the movie. That's
and, he's, and he feels out of place because you're watching all of these. And it's still it weirded me out when I saw it with my three-year-old daughter because I wasn't expecting the same songs for it to be kind of the same plot as the Disney film I grew up with. And it literally is like the same movie with the same songs and everything, just with these like
crazy. But only
crazy,
three of them. They don't even do whole deal, I don't think.
The ones that I remembered from my childhood were in there where they did like, I Want to Be Like You, and the ones that
Yeah, but in the movie, it's even, that's so creepy.
It's weird.
It's so creepy. Was it Christopher Walken, right?
Yeah.
He's so big, and the fact that he's wants to, it's just like this evil possession thing.
Like Baloo moved like kind of casually, and he danced in this one. It's just, he's kind of lumbering more.
Scarlett Johansson's that snake, it's a horror movie.
Yeah. But my daughter enjoyed it. So, I mean, I guess that's kind of where the newer generation is, and this is what they're seeing and what they're going to make these kind of sacred memories about. But
correct me if you're wrong, but I thought I saw you post about one of the recent Planet of the Apes movies and being kind of impressed by that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's funny about that. I mean, the first one, what I love about that is it's just so simple. It's such a simple story and it's so powerfully emotional.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've already talked about the first Planet of the Apes when I was a kid. And then we've got the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes with Rick Baker. And again, it harkens back to what I was saying about Rick. Those makeups are so perfect. I mean, I saw it at IMAX. Not IMAX. I saw it at, what the hell, the big screen?
IMAX.
IMAX.
Close.
Sorry, I'm promoting my magazine, my friends. it was sold out. And so I sat like on the far left in the front row. And man, from that view, the hair work was immaculate because you could see everything. But really, I mean, those were so perfect. And so when I heard that the movie was going to get remade and that they were creating all the characters digitally, I thought, that's it. That's it. I'm killing myself. I'm just going to fucking put a shotgun in my throat and sever my spinal cord because the one thing you could still do practically is a fucking ape makeup, right, on a person's face.
Right.
But the minute I walked in that theater and saw how the camera traveled with them, the way the apes were moving, the performances, there's no way you could even touch that with a guy in a suit. And it was magically beautiful. And so, listen, I'm not here to, shit on digital effects.
No, man, we're just talking movies.
Just because they stole my career, you know.
And let's talk a little bit about how – so Sandy Calora, another effects artist.
Yes.
Who you came up with. You worked with him quite a bit.
Sandy and I worked together on The Abyss way, way back when.
Right. And he has done several books like this successfully. So
yes.
Was he the one that kind of – once you realized that it wasn't going to work out with publishers, was he the one that talked you into doing this version of it, which was a crowdfunded Kickstarter book?
Yeah, that's correct because it made so much sense. And he's right. I mean when it, you know, an independent art movement, I mean this is kind of the way to do it. And I do have a little bit of a following, so we way overfunded on it.
Volume 2 is definitely coming.
We're gonna kick it for each one, unless a big publisher picks it up, which I'm also talking to some people now about. Which the only advantage to that would be we've got our team together. But you know, he was right in the following fact is that when you know I had no one to answer to, so it was finally like because you know when I closed my company in 2006, my effects company, I thought, well, one of the major reasons is I wanted to stretch as an artist, grow as a person, and I've always wanted to write. And so I took a bunch of years off and traveled from Costa Rica to New Orleans to Austin and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. And I thought, this is finally, I can do what I want because I'm the director of these scenes. I was writing fiction at the time. I'm the director, I'm the production designer, I'm the casting agent, I'm the actors, I'm everybody. This is great. Nobody's going to ever tell me what to do again because we all know I don't play well with others at this point, particularly after you read volume one. But then when the big publishers came in, you heard they're like, what? It was the same thing. You can't escape it. If you're lower on the food chain, yeah, just because they can, people are going to tell you to change this, cut this, redo this. So this, putting it out independently, I got to avoid all of that stuff. And I think it's what came from my heart. And I'm really proud of it. Whether it does great or doesn't, it got done. And it's a really, really representative of what I wanted to do. And so I'm really happy that it's coming out this way.
Yeah. I mean, I love coffee table books like this. Anything that's kind of a little bit of both, where you share your stories and we get all these pictures and stuff. So, and I mean, so far these just started going out, but you've already been getting some feedback and some reviews on it. So are you kind of happy with the response thus far?
Yeah. My favorite review is, this is the worst. Let me see if I can remember it. Rubberhead is the worst piece of literary shit to ever hit the market. Reading this book gave me AIDS.
Wow.
I like that one.
That's passionate.
Exactly.
Wow.
I mean, I've got to develop a thin skin. I'm getting great reviews. That is a real review, though, by the way. Not from an actual reviewer, but just somebody.
Yeah.
I was afraid that the time travel technique to tie all the disjointed stories together would lose people. I was afraid the Walter Mitty Daydreams would. I'm not getting that reaction at all. People are really loving it. But here's the thing. It's not really out yet because I don't want these Kickstarter people to get too angry. We just debuted at IMATS, the International Makeup Artist Trade Show, 2 weekends ago. Uh-huh. And it's not available on Amazon yet. It will be in about a week. It's going to be available on Kindle and also on whatever audio format we choose, because I've done an audiobook as well, which is a blast. But the thing is, it's not really out yet. Right now, though, it's live. As of today, on my website, stevejohnsoneffects.com,
yeah,
you can order the audiobook there. You can order the soft cover and the hard cover and a PDF download. Because, you know, part of the issue is the shipping if you're international.
Right.
So you can always get the audiobook and the PDF download, and there's a bundle for that. But the audiobook is such a blast. I mean, I would encourage everyone to do the digital version. Get the bundle, because it's actually cheaper than the hardcover. If you get the digital download and the audiobook, there's no shipping. I don't have to do anything. The customer doesn't have to do anything. Right. But you get my performance because I read the audiobook.
Yeah.
I test it. It's 6 hours, just volume one. And I was nervous about it because I've never really performed like that. And so I tested a few different techniques in reading.
You went with accents, didn't you?
I even sing in it. But that's, I do sing. When people sing, I have to sing.
I want the Giger accent kind of fluctuating throughout. I think it's fun.
He's smiling big. That means he does do a Giger accent.
Woo!
Maybe.
Giger's not in volume one.
Oh, okay, that's right.
But when I tested three different techniques on how to perform the best before we started sitting down and really doing our sessions, and one was stone cold sober, did not work. One was a little bit of wine, better, but didn't work. And the third one, which did work and what we went with, was absolutely shit face blasted out of my mind on marijuana edibles. So I am high as a goddamn kite in a hurricane the entire time when you read the audiobook. But what
do
I found is,
do you stay on tangent?
No,
do you
it makes me, or do
you go off?
I definitely go off. Okay. I go off script. I do asides, and it's just way better because I found that I slow down. Which you can hear I talk really quickly. So it slows me down. My enunciation is better and my performance is much better. And I'm having a blast doing it. So I know the reader, the listener is too. It's really fun. I can't wait to get some feedback on the audiobook.
That's awesome.
I should have done edible before I came over tonight.
And
for
part two.
I have a license, kids. It's California. It's okay.
It is
okay.
It's legal here, so it's all good.
Just to summarize, I loved a lot of the YouTube video stuff you're doing, and obviously you cataloged a lot of stuff. Besides the volumes of books and all the stuff that you cataloged here, any chance of doing more stuff with your videos? Would you consider maybe a documentary or just doing something? Because you really do have, as you called it, a treasure trove of really great material that you saved over the years.
Absolutely.
I would love to see more of it.
I've got two or three people that want to do a documentary now. And to me, that's the one tragedy about this book, is because when you're talking about effects, You want to see them move and breathe and live and walk and smile. And you can't really do that with this. And what I did toy around with for a while was, what about an interactive book where, you know, when I'm talking about John Landis and Don Rickles on Innocent Blood, you not only see our tests behind the scenes, but you see clips from the film and you get interviews with Don and Rick, Don and Landis, if you want to go that deep. It's just like, how far do you want to go?
Yeah.
But my God, it took me so long to get this out. I was like, okay, no, that's next level shit. We'll do that later. But yeah, documentaries and all kinds of stuff definitely are in the works because that stuff can't go to waste.
No, definitely not. Wow.
What's the one effects you have not done yet that you are really still hoping to get to do? Like, everybody I've talked to in the effects world always has one. Like, I really want to make a fish person, or I always wanted to make like a 10-foot tall alien with 9 heads. What is yours?
I'll tell you exactly what. Nothing so pedantic. I would love to direct something that I've written myself, because as I said, you'll find when you read this book, the series of books, that it's written as a narrative. I mean, because I've read so many scripts in my career, I couldn't help but write very visually. And everybody says, oh my God, this should be a movie. Mm-hmm. And that's because of reading all the scripts. And it's also because of reading Stephen King. And it's also because of writing all the fiction novels that I've written. So in every fiction novel I've written, and even in this book, my guilty pleasure is to create a monster with words. There's always the beast somewhere. But it's so interesting. Instead of sculpting it in clay, I'm sculpting it with words in your mind. And it's a very different process and really fulfilling. And so I would love to direct something that I've written and put one of those creations up on screen, because it will blow people away. So we'll see what happens. I mean, who knows what kind of ancillary things will happen from this. I think it's going to take some time to get some traction, to get the word out there. But it's kind of a fun project, and I think a lot of side projects may come of it.
Didn't you direct a short a couple of years ago? I'm trying to remember.
Many shorts, yeah. I won a Mobi video called Everloving that was shot all underwater with miniature puppets upside down and backwards and then deposited, composited to look dry. I did a 20-minute short film called Nightmare Cabin, which is a blast, when I was teaching a semester at the Tom Savini School.
I think that's the one I've seen that you shared. I thought was really cool.
Where I star on it and death comes to the door, but he's at the wrong door.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. I've directed a bunch of stuff. And then, you know, a couple episodes of Outer Limits way back when that was up and going. But I would just think if I could put something – I mean, this is why I would love to get my own anthology off the ground, because – I've got so many short stories, and I know so many people in the industry. It would just be brilliant to do another Masters of Horror thing, but that didn't even make it through 2 seasons. I don't know what the issue is. And look, Joe Hill was about to do Tales from the Dark Side, and that fell apart. If Joe Hill can't get something going.
Really? Oh, my God.
Yeah, I don't know what the problem is with anthologies, because I love them. I mean, Black Mirror is doing okay, I guess.
Yeah. All from the same guy. Yeah.
You better throw this microphone away.
Thankfully, he's got a screen
on
it. We
smoked some bad microphone.
give it to somebody you don't like next.
Yeah, that'll be easy, because Ryan's back next week.
Oh! Sorry, Ryan.
Turek, you got the plague.
Wow. Well, Steve, man, I really appreciate you coming down tonight and giving us a little bit of your time.
And thank you so much for the opportunity.
We'll need 5 parts to get to Sybil, to get to we didn't touch on that.
Every volume that comes out, we'll have you back.
Yeah,
you gotta talk
fantastic.
About it. That's what
I wanted that Bad Moon. Ask you the Bad Moon werewolf.
Oh, you can ask
her
before
you're
out.
Did
attack?
You do what in the Bad Moon werewolf part did you do? Was it that attack on the tent or something else in there? Do you remember that?
I did all of it,
because that's one. I think it's one of the best werewolf attacks in movies.
And I wanted to go back to like Humanoids of the Deep and things like that.
We could be here all night. Let's get some booze in here. No, I did all the werewolf stuff, all the effects on that. I mean, we were all really, including Eric Rad, the director, very disappointed with the horrendous transformation sequence, because the digital people at that time wanted to handle the transformations with 2D, and it's just a mess. And in the recent re-release of that film. Excuse me, Eric cut all that out.
Yeah.
Thank God.
There's a director's cut, and it actually works so much better.
Exactly. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, they cut that transformation out. Yeah,
but that werewolf was always one of my favorites.
The attack's great at the start. It's scary.
You guys don't know what you're talking about.
That's probably true.
No, it looks good in still frames, but the mouth never closes. And it's lingered on, I think, too much for too long. Oh, yeah. But, you know, I'm always my worst critic. Yeah.
I just always liked that one because it looked more, I'll call it canine-like. It looked more dog-like than a lot of the other werewolves of the time.
Thank you. That was my point. I mean, I was really inspired by an old Warren magazine, Eerie. There was a story with a werewolf in it that was configured exactly like that. And I always thought, oh my God, wouldn't that be cool to have an actual dog-like upper body with a human set, you know, more human set of legs. And that's what it was based on.
Yeah, it looked almost, I don't want to say terrier because you don't tend to think of terriers as being frightening, but it had those kind of more canine features than you would see with a lot of werewolves where they always have that elongated muzzle.
Yeah, and we furred the entire snout and most of the time it's bald and we colored it properly. The end of this casting. End of this talk is going to be awful because I can't stop coughing.
We're going to keep you alive until the end.
Got a cough drop?
Get him more water.
Yes, I do have
that
cough drops.
That would be great.
Becca does because she's always.
The last
always.
Podcast. What a grim tombstone for our show. This is not what we wanted.
No, you know what I find sometimes? Just chewing on toothpicks, which you, the audience doesn't see this because I can't smoke in here. That might have something to do with my cough. Yeah. And being sick as I chew toothpicks. And there's something about them that irritates my throat even more.
Could this be is the why. Wood.
Yeah, kids, that it's safer to smoke cigarettes than chew toothpicks. Don't start chewing toothpicks.
Try fair.
But we do appreciate you coming down, regardless of being just getting better from being sick and giving us your time. And so stevejohnsoneffects.com.
That's right. You can get the audiobook there. You can get the digital download. You can get the soft cover and the hard cover. If you want to wait, if you don't trust my website, you can wait a week or two and it'll be available on Amazon and Kindle and all that stuff.
Great. I contributed, so I'm waiting for my hardcover and I'm definitely going to get the audiobook.
Excellent. You should get it tonight.
All right.
One click. I tested it today. It works great.
Beautiful. All right. Thanks, Steve. Thanks, guys, for listening.
Steve.
We'll see you next week.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, man.
That was fun.